Like, this kind of stuff hasn't existed because we've never had an open identity protocol of the web where you can actually build an application like this, where you have that sort of social intelligence baked into the actual product itself.
It compounds that exponential value that you get just from a network effect alone. You actually have useful information, useful data upon which to make decisions about where you eat or what events you attend or what have you.
As you give up responsibility for things, you actually give up your freedom over them because you're no longer responsible. Somebody else is responsible. They have the freedom to choose over you.
Bitcoin changes incentives, it fixes certain things, but ultimately human action fixes things.
I don't want to rehash what already exists and just build a clone and put it on Nostra. I don't think that's interesting.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Alex Svetsky. This was a fantastic conversation. If you don't know Alex, he wrote Bushido of Bitcoin, fantastic book. I'm halfway through, but it is awesome. We talk a little bit about that at the beginning, but then we dive into his most recent projects, Atlantis. He's building on Nostr, and what he's doing, I think, is incredibly novel and unique. You gotta check this app out, support this guy. I think it's awesome work being done. You're gonna love this. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Alex here with me. Alex, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Good to see you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited for this conversation. I told you I'm halfway through Bushido Bitcoin. I just started it when we connected a couple weeks ago. I'm a slow reader. It's a beefy book.
It's a beefy that's not slow reading. That's actually fast. Well done.
Good. Okay, good. It's been my morning reading, sitting outside, taking in the sunshine. So I thought you'd be proud.
I love it.
So it's a fantastic read. We're going to spend actually a little bit less time on that today because we've got a lot of exciting stuff to get to related to your newest project. And I would like for you, though, to maybe for people who aren't familiar with Bushido, they haven't been around as long, they're just haven't gotten to it yet. What's sort of the thesis of the book and what prompted you to write it to begin with?
Yeah, so I was part of the sort of the 2016-2017 school of Bitcoin, and during that period, there was like this, almost what I call like the golden age of Bitcoin literature. And, you know, there was sort of like Robert Breedlove and Gigi and myself and Brandon Quidham and all these sort of people started like writing kind of like philosophy on Bitcoin. Like we started relating it to a bunch of different things. And I would say probably the only person who did any of that beforehand was Andreas Antonopoulos, but it wasn't really in written form. It was all in sort of spoken form. His written stuff was very technical. I guess you could also argue Goldstein and Pierre Rochard had done a little bit of work with the Nakamoto Institute in the early days. They had some great early pieces, but there wasn't really like this Bitcoin literature. There was no Bitcoin books. Like it was just the Bitcoin Standard and a couple random crypto books floating around. And in 2019, 2020, there was like this explosion of Bitcoin books. You know, you had like Canute and this and that. And, now there's like 10 million Bitcoin books, I love Bitcoin books. I love Bitcoiners and all this sort of stuff. But they all sort of like basically say the same thing. They're all kind of a variant on the Bitcoin Standard. It's, why money's broken, what's fucked up about it, how it destroys the world, and why Bitcoin's better, attributes of money, this and that. And, I spent a number of years like doing a bunch of writing for Zero Hedge, for Bitcoin Magazine, for all of that. And man, God knows, I must have written like 1-2 million words on Bitcoin. And in 2021, Mark Moss and I wrote the Uncommunist Manifesto, and we wanted to do something that was a little bit different. Like we were sort of, ahead of the curve, I guess, in the sense of pointing out the fallacies of the leftist movement and, where it was going and all this sort of stuff. And this was kind of like peak lockdown, hysteria, madness, and all this shit. And anyway, we published that. And at that stage, I was running a podcast called The Wake Up Podcast. And along the way, Eric Kaysen came onto my show and he and I discussed kind of like the emergent values or virtues in the Bitcoin space. And we also spoke about a favorite book of both of ours called Shogun, written by James Clavell, which has recently become like a show, I think, on HBO or whatever. And we spoke about sort of this like ancient code of virtue or code of honor that the samurai class, the warrior class of the Japanese had. And anyway, that podcast I titled The Bushido of Bitcoin. And that planted the original seed of the idea for me was, you know, hey, could I write a book on these emergent values or emergent virtues in the Bitcoin space? And that was what the idea originally started as. But as I say in the book, like, man, I wrote 8 drafts of that fucking thing. Like, you know, I rewrote it, and it changed me. Then I changed it, and it changed me, and I changed it. It was like a real sort of interesting process, an interesting period of my life. You know, I was also transitioning from being like a single guy into a, you know, settled down relationship, into a marriage and all this sort of stuff. Also coming out of being an entrepreneur, I went to war with like the Australian government and all this sort of stuff about like, you know, my prior company, and then all the lockdowns. Like, so there was this whole like transition. I like really evolved as a person. And what came from that was this book. And ultimately, and this is a long way of answering your question, but what the book ultimately became about was the question that I felt hadn't been answered very well in the Bitcoin space, which is, when Bitcoin wins, what then? I had discovered, because I spent some time a little bit outside of the Bitcoin space, I'd discovered these like new, call it like communities or groups of people that had no reference point with Bitcoin. They didn't know what Bitcoin was, all this sort of shit. They didn't really even give a shit. You know, they just sort of like lumped it with all the crypto stuff. But they were men of virtue. They were people who I was like, man, these guys are based as fuck. They know what's going on. They're articulate. They're smart and all this sort of stuff. And I started getting into these like sort of, I guess, you know, they would be called like the right-wing communities. And at the same time, I noticed that there was a bunch of retards in the Bitcoin space as well. And my wiring like sort of short-circuited, because I was sort of this opinion that, you know, Bitcoin changes you, it makes you more of a person, all this sort of stuff. But then I was like, wait a minute, I've got evidence pointing clearly to the contrary here. And that sort of learning, that catalyst helped, you know, transform the book for me, which was, okay, when Bitcoin wins, the people holding the Bitcoin all of a sudden end up with significant wealth, which is significant power. What happens to those people? Do they become like a new parasitic class? Do they become a bunch of retards driving Lambos and, you know, just posting memes? Or do they become men and women of virtue? And then I asked the question, okay, what is virtue? What does it actually mean? And I realized, you know, there's this big difference between values and virtue. Values are something you desire. Virtue is something you do. It's a behavior. And as I looked at what that meant, I realized behavior is what's upstream of culture, and culture is actually upstream of civilization. So the big question for me is, if we want to rebuild an ascendant civilization, what is the culture we must have, and therefore what is the behaviors we might have? And that sort of ties back into what the book ended up being, which is a kind of like a guidebook for how we rebuild the world on a Bitcoin standard. You know, the Bitcoin standard is kind of the economic piece, and that's important. But then it's the social, human, civilizational, cultural piece. It's like, what do we build above that? Because if we just become a bunch of degenerates, like it defeats the purpose of having one on the Bitcoin standard in the first place. And to me, having been around Bitcoin now for a decade and seen what's happened to a lot of early Bitcoiners who have Bitcoin, they just turned into absolute morons. It made me realize that it's not that Bitcoin changes you. It's a necessary ingredient, but there's something more. So that's basically what the book is about.
Yeah, I love that take. So I'm curious, what if I can only imagine like the wrestling you did with yourself going back and like digging in for all these concepts to write 500 plus pages, I think it is. A lot of research done, obviously. You're referencing different cultures and the virtues and the values that they espoused, and you know, the origins. What was the thing that changed in you the most in the writing process? It sounds like a cliche question. I promise I didn't plan it, but I'm just curious. Like Bitcoin has changed me a lot, and I've gone down a lot of rabbit holes. I'm curious, for someone who's kind of dug deeper external to Bitcoin, but you know, along these different sort of the cultural, just the different ways culture have approached virtue throughout the ages. Like, what is it for you that's resonated most?
I'll try and answer 2 parts of that question. One is my reverence. So I was a very sort of Austrian economics kind of maxi before writing this book, and you know, really believed that economics was the basis of civilization and all of this. And as I wrote the book, I realized that there's something much more transcendent. Like, economics is a very necessary base; it's a foundation, but really, what gives civilization meaning and spirit is it's kind of the what I would call like the spirit of excellence. It is this desire to climb and to reach. And what I've noticed is not all cultures have that. In fact, very few cultures have that. The cultures that are the greatest throughout history seem to have this spark inside them. So I guess to kind of summarize that, I would say it's this reverence for excellence and beauty. They were the sort of the two things that I found really important that were actually completely not economic in nature. Like, you look at a cathedral that would take 300 years to be built. There's zero like economic benefit in doing that. Like, you're not going to see the investment through. You're going to die. It makes no fucking economic sense. Like, there's no like Austrian economic argument you can make for building a beautiful cathedral and to put your money into it, right? But there is a deeper sort of like spiritual. And I don't mean that in a woo-woo sense. Like, I mean something sort of like deep within us that inspires us to climb, to elevate, to ascend. And, you know, there was no like, you know, you look at Alexander the Great, for example. I write a lot about him in the book. You know, the goal wasn't to go and like make money, you know, or to like go and steal the gold and all this sort of stuff. You know, he gave that all away along the way. The goal was to reach the ends of the earth, to go where no other man had gone before, to do what nobody else had done before. And that spirit, I realize, is way more important than Bitcoin. It's way more important than, you know, sound money and Austrian economics and all that sort of stuff. There's just something more special there. Notwithstanding, it is absolutely necessary to have a stable economic base in order to do that. Because if you don't have the stable economic base, you can't actually do that. It's kind of the analogy would be, you know, you don't want to go and build a house without the plumbing there. Otherwise, the house will be full of shit, right? So you can go and like, so the two things are necessary, but I found a lot of something deep there. And what I would say is that changed me in the sense that when I first started writing the book, there was the, you know, one day maybe I'll actually share the first or second draft, but it was a much darker, nostalgic book. Like, I was like, you know, the world is fucked, everyone's retarded, and you know, we need to go back to a certain age. But by the end of the book, what I realized, and it wasn't just the psychological realization, it was a visceral one, right? It wasn't just like, oh, I know this, because many people say this psychologically, but this became like a visceral thing for me, which is the sense that we're right where we need to be. And we're having the exact fight that we need to have in order to transcend and build something else. So like the quote-unquote fall or the disintegration of Rome led to the rising of the Germanic tribes and the new Europe, which would come to be 10,000 times more powerful than what Rome was previous to that, right? So it's the tearing of the muscle fibers at the gym that we have to go through now. So what changed in me writing the book was like, I fucking had this new, call it an energy, call it a vitality, call it a mission, call it something that fired up inside me as I wrote the book.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I think this is an important call to action for Bitcoiners, because I remember going to my first Bitcoin event after kind of beginning to go down the rabbit hole. And I think what I just kind of gotten on Twitter and I saw that everyone seems to be a carnivore and everyone's reading Austrian economics books, right? And so like I was like, this is going to be like the coolest conference. Everyone's going to be like jacked, tan, you know, have their life together, all this stuff. And I showed up and it was like, looked like just the most normal people, you know, you could possibly imagine. That's not necessarily a criticism. I think everyone's on a path, right? And like, I've come a long ways in the last 3 years since I found Bitcoin, and I think everyone, you know, begins to piece that together. But what you're hitting on here is that it is a point that actually one of my favorite Bitcoiners, a friend of mine, made, and it's that we have this, you know, this saying in Bitcoin, well, Bitcoin fixes this. And he's like, no, like Bitcoin changes incentives, it fixes certain things, but ultimately human action fixes things. And I think what you're hitting on is you can't have the bright orange future without the change in people that you need, because you can have just a bunch of wealthy degenerates, you know, we're going to be rich and depressed or whatever. Like, that's a very real possibility if people aren't aligning or orienting themselves toward these virtues that we know to be useful and productive in our lives.
100%.
So I think this is an incredibly important thing. One thing you mentioned, you said freedom's not a virtue. The goal is actually maximum responsibility and autonomy. Could you explain that concept? And then I want to move on, because we've got a lot to cover on everything else you're doing.
I'm glad you picked that one up. Have you hit the responsibility section yet of the book?
I haven't okay. yet.
Dude, that one's fucking fire. You're gonna love it. It's the one that hundreds of people have emailed me, said, holy shit, this chapter is the best thing I've ever read in my life. So I talk about it in there. So freedom is not a virtue. It is a value. So we all value freedom in some sense. But the only way you can get freedom is through responsibility. And I've started using the word autonomy more than freedom, because I feel like freedom is a little bit of it's almost like a childish or an adolescent term. And I mean that because it's very hard to define. It's very ephemeral. Breedlove and I kind of had a sort of back and forth debate on this. And, you know, we didn't end up agreeing on it. But my framing of autonomy is some sort of blend of conscious responsibility and establishment of a domain in which you have freedom. So it's the knowledge of the existence of a boundary that must exist in order for you to establish a zone of freedom internally. And to make that more clear, let me explain it this way. When the communists in the past wanted to take away people's freedom, they did it very overtly. They grabbed people, threw them into fucking gulags, and, you know, the rest was history, right? What ended up happening was a massive pushback against that. And, you know, you had these sort of communist regimes and everything fall apart. What they learned was that you could introduce communism much more effectively if you slowly took away people's responsibility over things. And when you slowly take away the responsibility, you know, hey, look, we'll manage your money, we'll manage your health, we'll manage your education, we'll manage your media intake, we'll manage your food, we'll manage everything. All of a sudden, as you give up responsibility for things, you actually give up your freedom over them, because you're no longer responsible. Somebody else is responsible. They have the freedom to choose over you. Because when you don't have responsibility over something, you actually can't choose. And choice is actually the basis of all freedom. So this was it actually ties into your previous question. One of the things that sort of changed, that was a total freedom maxi beforehand. And after writing the book, I sort of became this, you know, I think I even published an article for Bitcoin Magazine in the early days of writing the book. I called it Responsibility Go Up Technology, which is what I was talking about Bitcoin. You know, everyone talks about NGU. I was like, no, there's something more important here. There's RGU. It's like this thing is about enhancing or increasing the level of responsibility. And as you increase responsibility, you increase adulthood, you increase realism, and you increase not maximal freedom, but localized freedom, which comes back to my sort of attempted definition for autonomy. It's like, it's localized freedom within my domain, but it's also a recognition that I can't just have freedom to do whatever I want. Like, infinite freedom or freedom maximalism, I think, is a little bit naive.
Interesting. Okay. No, I think it's an interesting way of framing it. I would need to like sit on that concept for a while and really, really think, because for me, like, freedom has been like, it's just been a word that's sort of been chosen and used in many cases that I sort of conceptually understand what I mean when I say it, what other people mean when I say it. But I hear what you're saying. Actually, an analogy I've heard is the pastor at our church recently used this. He was talking about, so, I mean, take it or leave it, is, you know, if you're a spiritual person, you believe in God or not. But he used the analogy of, we have like these confines in which we're supposed to live optimally. And so, yes, you can go beyond that if you want, but is that going to be optimal for you? Mm-hmm. And the analogy he used was a train off of its tracks. What is that? Well, it's chaos. It's, you know, like, it was designed for this specific purpose. And just because it's quote unquote free doesn't actually make it better. And I think that, humans were really designed to live in a particular way within these particular virtues that you describe in your book. And we have the option to opt out, but we have consequences when we make those decisions. Yeah, you have freedom, right? Like, you can do whatever you want, but are you really more quote unquote free when you choose to exercise that rather than to opt for responsibility and what you're describing here?
Spot on. 100%.
I think that's great. Hey, you mentioned offline this notion of a borderless manifesto, and then I want to transition into your latest gig. This is a really cool way of framing what I think you see as maybe a movement that's bigger than just, and again, I need to choose my terms wisely with you, but, you know, like self-sovereignty and, you know, sovereign money and digital, you know, being a digital nomad. Like, you kind of encompass many different aspects of what we think of as this life that many people desire into this notion of borderlessness. Mm-hmm. Could you maybe explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, for sure. So I appreciate that. This is actually, I'll make a disclaimer here. This is the first time I'm even speaking about this publicly. I haven't even, you know, I literally, it hit me at the gym 2 days ago. I was like trying to come up with a term that encompasses these like rising movements towards, you know, greater location independence, to greater sovereignty, monetary location, physical, personal, familial, all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I've been asking myself this question for like 2 years now. It's like, what, how can I name this movement? Because sovereignty, as I mentioned to you offline, it sounds like a little bit, I mean, to Bitcoiners, it makes sense because we've all read The Sovereign Individual and stuff like that. The word feels a little bit heavy. And then to people outside, and we did a bunch of tests of like, you know, what does sovereignty mean to you? And people sort of straight away relate it to like monarchy or sort of white supremacist groups and stuff like that. And I was like, what the fuck?
not helpful.
like, all right. There's an interesting sort of association to this word. So what the idea of like borderless is trying to and you know what, I will also say, like, I'm not entirely sold on this term, because, you know, there's this idea of like borderless. Does that mean, hey, everyone should just come and live wherever the fuck they want and like open the borders and stuff? I'm totally against that. Like, I actually think you need strong borders around particular territories and everything so that you can maintain cultural cohesion, stuff like that. So that's a whole other rabbit hole. So I'm thinking of it more like a lifestyle. So you've got, I mean, Bitcoin's the sort of the big one, right? You've got money that is borderless, that allows you to store value across time, space, and transact it with anybody, anywhere, at any time, without permission, irrespective of country, of location, of anything, right? So that is ultra, ultra powerful. The internet was also supposed to be a communication medium that was borderless, right? You could talk to anyone, anywhere, anytime, at the speed of light, etc. You know, the internet is kind of like, had a bunch of KYC borders and, you know, all this sort of stuff kind of brought onto it, which has kind of limited its promise. But, you know, there's, you know, the very nature or the topography of the internet allows us to kind of route around that stuff, which is great. But in recent years, we've seen, particularly since the lockdowns and COVID, this sort of desire for people to have more physical sovereignty or physical location independence. Like, you know, I have multiple passports. I have multiple residencies. I have the ability to live wherever I want, right? So, you know, you've got this kind of like rise of the passport bros, as you see on Twitter and stuff like that, people selling, you know, sovereignty and citizenships and visas and residencies and all this sort of stuff. So that way you can create some more independence or some more quote unquote sovereignty or borderless listener, right? Like, you have multiple passports, you can go wherever you want, depending on your passport, you know, multiple residencies, same thing. You know, and that's sort of tied to taxes. So you're not stuck, you know, within a jurisdiction where you're a fucking tax cow or a slave to one, you know, one mob boss, basically. You know, there's also this like idea of, you know, coming out of the mainstream thought patterns around food, you know, sort of like being a carnivore, buying direct from the butcher, doing no seed oils, you know, buying locally. Circular economies is another big one as well. It's like all of these things are related. And what I've sort of noticed over the last couple of years is that each one of these are kind of like, there's a similar spirit behind all of them, is this, you know, idea of greater choice, greater flexibility, greater sovereignty. And I think the word I like to use again is independence of some level, right? Like, I personally like the idea that I can build communities, perform commerce, and build a life that is on my terms and by my design, not by what some retarded mainstream authority or media or government said so. And I mean, there's no end. That's basically my off-the-cuff riff of what I'm thinking that this sort of borderless movement is, what it encapsulates.
I think the borders are both, I think most people, to your point, I think they think about, like, you think about like a digital nomad, you know, moving around and living without physical borders, so to speak. But I think a lot of this is, like, when you think about money and when you think about communication, something we're going to talk about, and in communities, right? It's like this optionality and this ability to sort of optimize these different facets of life with new technology, new capabilities. And I think that maybe leads to a good segue into to Satlantis, actually, because you're building something very cool. I got my first look at it at BTC Prague, and built on Nostr. I think you ought to give everyone a quick primer on Nostr. I think most people have heard of it at this point. I think there are a lot of people, myself, I'm just getting back into the game. What is it? What do you view its role being in terms of future communication, future networking? Mm-hmm. And then tell me a bit about Satlantis and who it is, what it's for.
For sure, man. So I have a very contrarian opinion on Nostr. So if you go into the Nostr community and you'll hear people, you know, talking about free speech and censorship resistance and, you know, this is where the free internet is and all this sort of stuff. And while, you know, somewhat I philosophically agree with that, I actually don't, first of all, I don't think that's the selling point for the world, because 99.9% of people don't give a shit anyway. So I don't think that is really a good selling point. Number two, I think that sort of the ship has sailed, or maybe 1B, that ship has sailed. People kind of already perceive things like Substack and Rumble and all these other things that have a lot more traction as more censorship resistant anyway. And I think we're sort of past the days of getting banned on Twitter and stuff like that anyway. Like, the culture has shifted. I think we've had some massive, like, cultural wins over the last 18 months that have changed the world. So I think for me, what I find interesting about something like Nostr, and I choose my words very precisely here. I say something like Nostr because Nostr may not be the thing that succeeds. It may be something else that looks and feels and functions like Nostr. The bet at the moment is that Nostr is probably the leading horse in the race, or the leading candidate in this sort of movement. But let me take a step back and explain what the original vision of this Nostr thing was, long before Nostr came about. So in the beginning of the internet, there was always a dream or a vision to have a native protocol on the web for identity. And what that means is, like, so just like the web is kind of, you've got like TCP, IP, HTTP, you've got like these four layers to the web, upon which every single application, so if you can imagine like a cloud on the top, like every single application from Amazon to Google to your internet banking to any app that you're using, whatever, the design space that the four layers of the internet gave us have given us all of this space to create all of these different applications. But for every single one of these applications, because like portable identity was never a thing, or an identity protocol was never a thing, identity has lived as a feature inside the application that lives on top of the protocols, if that makes sense. And it's been the same with money as well, actually. If you look at money, what is money in a online banking or on Stripe? It's just a feature. Like, money doesn't actually move across the internet. What happens is you have a product like Stripe that has an internal ledger, which is just a database, that creates debit and credit entries so that it looks like your money is moving, but the money is actually not moving. So with the advent of Bitcoin, we actually have money as a protocol. So the money is actually moving from wallet to wallet, right? And Nostr is a little bit like that. It's a manifestation of the original dream of the internet, which was a portable identity, where the identity is a public-private key pair. It's a bearer instrument, very much like how Bitcoin is a bearer instrument. You know, when I hold Bitcoin and I send it to you, I've actually sent my Bitcoin to you. I no longer have it. And there's no third party that has like created a debit or credit entry. It's like from me to you. Likewise with Nostr, it's I can sign a message with my key and it is me. I actually own my identity. It's me. My identity doesn't live inside a third party application as a feature, right? In LinkedIn has a copy of my identity with LinkedIn. Twitter has an identity. Internet banking has an identity. This other app has an identity, blah, blah, blah. Everything has an identity. So I have a million and one identities that are features. Nostr kind of changes the paradigm. It pushes the identity down to the protocol level, which means then applications can focus on delivering a service and you with your single identity can just, it kind of even changes the idea of a login because you're not logging in anymore. You are actually just unlocking access. You have a key and you're just like entering all of these different places. And each of these different places on the web, products, services, websites, whatever, tailor themselves live to you because you have different preferences and different, you know, a different profile. It's you now. So if you enter the same application that I enter, it looks different because you and I are different people with different preferences and a different key, right? So that's sort of like the dream or the vision. Now, it's extremely early days. You know, Nostr sort of rolled out, I think, 3 or 4 years ago now. It has come a long way, technically speaking, I will say. It has stalled out a little bit in terms of growth, though. There's a lot of people in the Nostr space get triggered when you sort of bring this up, but it's the nature of things. I think the way Nostr has been presented to the market with the whole censorship resistant, free speech and everything like that, I think has fallen flat. I don't think that's a good enough pitch. So for me, when I look at Nostr, I see, look, okay, you have a rich identity protocol where, and this is probably the other thing I'll mention here that makes Nostr unique, is that you don't just have an identity, but you have metadata associated to the identity. So one piece of metadata is my profile photo. Another piece of metadata is my bio. But the most important piece of metadata is my follow list and who follows me. That's hyper, hyper important because then I can be on a certain application, let's say Primal or Damus, and let's say for whatever reason, 3-4 years after I'm working on this and I've built up a following, Primal or Damus disappear. I don't know, something happens, whatever, they get deleted, they get banned, whatever. My entire follow account is associated to my key, to my identity. So I just log into the next apps, Atlantis, whatever, and the entire follower graph is there. Maybe not all the data, because maybe Primal was running a particular relay and the relay went down and everything, but that's not the important part. The important part is that my relationships, my social graph is still there. That's where all the fucking value is. So if I bring it back to now, what I'm trying to do with Atlantis, I saw this and I was like, okay, this is a social graph as a service. That's what it is. Like Nostr is a tool which allows this whole new, like if you now look at the internet, so you had these four layers before, now you have Bitcoin and you have Nostr. So you have money as a protocol and you have identity as a protocol. That's a whole new design space to start building new and interesting applications that couldn't previously exist. And that's effectively what Atlantis is. I thought, all right, I want to build something where if I'm traveling, I go to a new city, instead of me messaging 50 people saying, hey, which place do I go to, which restaurant, which cafe, which gym, which this, which that, all this sort of bullshit, I can land and I can immediately see who in my social circle has recommended what, bookmarked what, suggested what, posted about what, etc. And I have like a relevant, almost like imagine you could go to Google Maps and the places you see are influenced by who you know. And when you look at the reviews, I see a review from you instead of some fucking rando that I don't know. Like that's the key piece. So anyway, I won't go into Atlantis just yet, but that's the nature of, in my opinion, what Nostr is. It's a rich identity protocol that gives us an open global social graph that you can build new applications on. That's how I would summarize it.
So you know what I love about this? I'm excited for you to get to Atlantis, because what I love about this is it seems like it brings like a potential for authenticity to the social, to the internet-based relationships with that we have, that today you really, I mean, you got a zillion followers. It makes you think a lot harder potentially about like, who are the people that I really want to engage with? Who do I want following me? You know, what sort of content do I put out there in order to attract the right people to me? Like, there's an incentive, like the incentives now align for you to like really foster a community and not necessarily to, you know, like clickbait, you know, like a lot of the stuff that we see, because you want to think long and hard about whose recommendations do I want when I land in a city, and who are the people who align with me philosophically in terms of the lifestyle, the way they eat, you know, like whatever. So who did you design Setlantis for, and what, like, how would you describe what you've, like, this tool that you've now built on top of the Nostr protocol?
Really good question. So let me, I want to answer this in a couple of ways. So,
take your time.
I built this for basically what we described earlier as the people who are interested in, you know, borderless living, Bitcoin, sovereignty, health, like all this sort of stuff, like the, you know, what we discussed earlier. And whether that is a digital nomad, whether that is a passport bro, whether that is a Bitcoiner looking to, you know, establish a place in a circular economy outside of the system with his family and all this sort of stuff, whatever it is, all of these sort of people share something in common, which, as I said, is that thread of a desire for greater control, sovereignty, and ownership of their life, right? So that's basically what I would call like the target market, right? And what I then thought about is, okay, what do these people need? Well, they want to connect with other people. So you need profiles. And, you know, these profiles, again, these profiles should be keys in which the profile has the option to be owned by the key holder, right? So that way you have your own profile. This is you. And it is your, I hate to use the word digital identity because it conjures up other thoughts, but this is a sovereign digital identity, right? It's something that you own, and you can have as many of these as you want. And it wasn't something that was issued to you by the EU or, you know, some idiot government. It was something that you generated as a mathematical key pair. That's it. So it's just cryptographic key. So you want to have this sort of topography so that you can link people up. But then you also want to, like, people are interested in places. Like, we are always going to different places on a regular basis. Like, and, you know, that could be, I don't know, your local butcher who accepts Bitcoin, or it could be, you know, your favorite restaurant that maybe or maybe not they accept Bitcoin, doesn't matter, but it's like, I come visit you and this is the place that you recommend to all of your friends. You know, it could be a sauna, it could be a beach, could be a trail, could, like, anything that's physical on a map. You want to know or be able to identify which places are right for you. So could we use this sort of like social graph element to start to surface stuff that is more relevant based on, you know, who discovered this place, who added it to the map, who recommended it, who bookmarked it? Like, the bookmarking, I think, is so fucking powerful. Like, you know, I have not seen a single bookmarking application in the world at the moment where your bookmarks, for example, could be, like, particularly your map bookmarks, you can make them selectively public so that you could either share it with a friend, or friends that are coming to visit you or whatever the case is can quickly and easily discover, okay, you've been there, this is, you know, I trust you and we have similar interests and therefore I should go there. Like, you know, there's a lot of friction that happens there, and we're still living in the era of fucking TripAdvisor and Google Maps, which is all just like completely just like a bunch of unknowns, randos. And now these days, everything is fucking fake. Everything is fake. Like, the only way to get around that is by having some sort of reputation and social graph element. There's no other way around it. So that's sort of the second piece. And then the third pillar, and this is the sort of the third piece of what Setlantis is, like, we call it Setlantis people, places, and events. Events is the third piece. It's that, like, since the whole fucking world got locked down, and forced in our homes and everything, there's been this resurgence of a desire for people to get together in real life. And that is, you know, manifested in both like conferences on the large scale, but also everything from like, you know, people want to sort of run dinner events and retreats and like get togethers and gatherings and like men's groups and women's groups and all that. Like, there's a bunch of movement for people trying to connect again, because as much as like the internet has become this like tool for connecting all of us, the fact that social media has taken over the internet and we've seen the death of social networks, and these are two different things. I'll explain the difference in a minute. But as social media has sort of taken off and the internet has become this kind of like place full of slop, it's basically like a strip mall where every single thing is trying to fucking sell you something, we have actually lost a lot of connection. We're missing that big time. So people are craving the ability to go to events and to meet people and all this sort of stuff. So we, when we were looking at this thing, we're like, okay, we want to build something that unifies people, places, and events and ties them all together. Like, the glue is the social graph. So when you want to discover events, you would go to the events tab and you would see almost like, the current website doesn't show this yet, because when we originally first built this, we were taking more of like a location-centric approach. But what we realized was we were kind of confining ourselves to particular cities, and that kind of turned into a bit of a shitstorm. So we've kind of moved away now. We're going more for a global approach where you can do events and places and everything anywhere in the globe. And where there's concentrations, we geofence a destination around it. But anyway, without getting into the technicalities there, basically you open up the events tab and you can see, oh, here's a trending Bitcoin events. Here's, you know, some carnivore events that my friends are going to. Here's like something that is hosted by someone I know or someone that I share interests with, et cetera. And then when you join an event, you see the attendees and it shows you the attendees in order of who you are most likely to connect with and match with. Like, this kind of stuff hasn't existed because we've never had an open identity protocol of the web where you can actually build an application like this, where you have that sort of social intelligence baked into the actual product itself. So anyway, that's I've gone off on a couple tangents, but yeah, the people we're trying to build this for is these people who want more choice, sovereignty, ownership of their lives, that, you know, value location independence, lifestyle, all this sort of stuff. And we're trying to build it in such a way that these three key pillars, people, places, and events, are all tied together through the social graph element, so that you have relevance and personalization and something real when you go into the app instead of just a bunch of fake random bullshit.
So very cool. You made me wonder though, is there a threat to either at the application layer or at the protocol layer, where we could end up with like a bunch of garbage, fake, you know, reviews, what have you? And is there a way to incentivize or perhaps for like something like Bitcoin, you know, zapping sats, for example, to filter out the noise, the bots, whatever else might, you know, has sort of plagued much of the internet today.
Good question. You actually don't even need the zaps. You don't even need the Bitcoin piece. All you need is the social graph and a web of trust. So let me explain what a web of trust is. If I follow you, there's an element of trust there because I have chosen voluntarily to follow you, and no third-party platform can force me to follow you, because remember, I'm the one holding the key. So I've chosen to follow you. And if you recommend a place, your recommendation is valid to me. Now, let's say at the same time, a bot has created an account and they've said this place is shit and posted a fake review, but I don't follow that bot. And none of the people that I know follow that bot. So therefore, that bot has basically a zero trust score in relation to me. Therefore, their crap doesn't show up. This is entirely fucking possible within the silos, like within Facebook, within Instagram, and all this sort of stuff. This is actually possible. And in fact, they use a lot of this to try and, you know, clean bots out of your feed. Because believe me, like, those platforms are so full of bots. Like, if they didn't use some sort of internal web of trust stuff, like, it would be fucking full. And even with that, they don't do a great job. This, if we have an open social graph for the web, we can do this much better. We can avoid all of that crap by using Web of Trust tools. And you just have to tweak the level of trust, because there's a balancing act here to be done, which is, what about new accounts, and how do new accounts get visible and all this sort of stuff. I think the only realistic way to do that is that new accounts, new people actually have to find real friends, kind of like what we did on Facebook 20 years ago, if you remember, right? Like, you had to have a friend, and the friends went both ways, right? Like, that kind of stuff creates a more trusted social graph. So it creates almost like a barrier to entry for bots, because if you're a normal sentient human being, you're not going to fucking follow a bot. You don't care, right? So you're going to follow real people, and you're going to start to establish real relationships, which ties maybe into what I wanted to talk about, the difference between social network and social media. But before I do that, like, does that kind of answer the question? Like, I don't think we need Zaps. I think we solve this through Web of Trust.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's almost something that transcends a network effect. It's like a social effect. It's not just like the more people who use it, but the more people who like contribute value, and the more of these interconnected relationships you have, and the people you, by intent, through human action, determine, this is my community. Yeah. These are the people who I follow.
Correct.
It compounds that exponential value that you get just from a network effect alone, because you actually have useful information, useful data upon which to make decisions about where you eat or what events you attend or what have you.
The relationships are where the value is, exactly. It's the interconnected relationships. That's where all the value is. So if you can build an application where the tools are useful in and of themselves, and then as more people come to use the tools, so like, I don't know, are you familiar with like Luma as an events app?
I've heard of it. I've never used it.
So Luma is like a great new events app, and they're sort of going after Eventbrite or Meetup.com or whatever, right? So we're building, inside Solent is the equivalent of a Luma, but where we have an edge on Luma is that we have the social graph element. So basically our approach to market is to build a premium, like an awesome tool, which you would use irrespective of the social graph piece. You use it because it's the fucking best place to host events. And guess what? Unlike Luma, you can host an event, and you can do ticketing in Bitcoin. You can do ticketing in fiat if you want. You can do whatever, right? So you've got this kind of like awesome events app. But then as people join, so every time someone joins in a RSVPs to an event, they actually become a user of Solantis, and they can find other future events and all this sort of stuff. But now all of a sudden, each person who joins, they join this other event, they start to show what their interests are, and then slowly by slowly, you start to get this sort of social graph of the relationships. It's like, okay, you, Mike, have been to 3 other events that this other person has been to, and they become like a suggested account on your feed, right? Because there's an implied potential relationship there. So then you guys might connect, and then you start to get these interconnected relationships. So that's sort of, you build an awesome tool, and people come for the tool, and ultimately they stay for the network. And when they stay for the network, then you start to get this, what I guess you would call it, an exponential value in the product, which is people now find extra value by being in there, and then they host event themselves, or they add a place on the map themselves, or they review something, or they add it to a bookmark, and all this sort of stuff. And it all starts to come together.
Okay, so fill me in on the distinction between social networks and social media.
All right, so social networks was where it all started with Facebook, or even MySpace and stuff like that 2 decades ago. And effectively what these things were a digital representation on what we did in real life, right? So we all have friends, we have friends of friends, we have social networks effectively in real life. It's what we do. We are social creatures. About 10 years ago, or about 9 years ago, whatever it was, I think it was Google's DeepMind team were working on a problem for YouTube. They'd bought YouTube, I think, a couple years beforehand, and they were trying to increase the amount of watch time per user, right? So at that time, YouTube was still, if you remember in the early days, it was the videos that you saw came from the people's channels you subscribe to, right? Discovery wasn't that great. So they wanted to increase discovery of new creators and new content and increase watch time. So they started building basically what was the first recommendation algorithm for people watching YouTube. that took off. I think they increased like watch time by 3,000%, something like that. You know, people actually, you know, got in there and started watching.
Yeah.
You know, and look, it was great for discovery, but as with all of these sort of technological things, you know, there's a trade-off, right? Like they increased the discoverability, but they also increased the fucking consumption. Then they realized, hey, we can sell more ads. So, you know, it is what it is. I'm not going to comment on the morality of it, but that's sort of what happened. Then what happened was ByteDance, who was the parent company of TikTok in China. This was before TikTok had launched in the West. They were called Douyin in China. They picked up on that. They started building their own recommendation algorithm. Then Facebook did the same. And everybody started basically doing the same. And these recommendation algorithms were originally for the purpose of increasing discoverability of content. But they became, or, you know, and again, I'm being very kind, but they became sort of these things to increase engagement. Like, how do you serve content that will increase the time that people spend on the device? And the way the human mind works, the way the limbic system works, is that we are alerted to certain things. Like, if you think back 100 years ago, if you saw two newspapers at the newsstand and one said, oh, it's a sunny day, everything's going to be fine, and the other one said, danger, there is a storm coming, blah, 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 which one are you going to pick up? The danger, right? So like, and this is where the saying, if you're familiar, like if it bleeds, it leads, right? So media is designed to trigger you and to like capture you into a panic mode. It's designed to increase your adrenaline and to sort of hook you, right? Like, and so since, you know, over the last 10 years, we've had this sort of rise of the hook culture, right? You got to write something in a particular way, you got to capture someone, you got to grab their attention, you got to suck them in, you got to like basically sell them something. And what happened was these social networks slowly evolved into social media. So these days, you don't see anymore, like on Instagram or Twitter or anything, like stuff from the people you follow. There's no sort of like, you know, yeah, you might subscribe to 50 channels on YouTube. And, you know, YouTube still does show you some of the stuff that you're subscribed to. But, you know, now it just shows you a bunch of shit that is designed to like grab you and suck you in. So we had this like move towards social media. And for better or worse, like it's great for discovery, as I said, but it sucked us into these like vortexes of like content hell, as I call it. Like everyone's trapped on their device. And in my opinion, this ties back into why I want to build Atlantis, is there's a massive gap for social networks again. And I actually think people are craving that. The more I talk to people, the more they're like, man, I just want to find a fucking event and go there, and I go on Instagram and I get sucked into Instagram for 30 minutes and I just like lost 30 minutes of my life because I was looking for something. It's like, oh, you know, I'm in a new city. I want to find a cool restaurant to eat. You know, I Google shit. So I go on Instagram and all of a sudden I lost an hour of my life. It's like, kind of just go somewhere where I can open this up and just find something, you know, a community, whatever. So the only way, in my opinion, to do that is to rebuild social networks from the ground up. And I think Nostr is a powerful tool to do that. And I think what you need to have on top of Nostr is a really compelling context layer, which is basically, if I had to summarize what Atlantis is, it's a context layer for places and events. Like it's a map and an events app that uses the social graph to enhance the utility of the discovery piece. That's really like what it is.
So I think you've also described it as what was it called? Foursquare 2.0? Was that the I never used Foursquare, but I think I was familiar with the concept when it came. Is that still a thing, by the way? Like, do people use that? Yeah, or so did Facebook buy them or something?
No one uses it. Foursquare didn't buy them. Sorry, Facebook didn't buy them. They bought Instagram instead. So Foursquare became a B2B infrastructure player, actually. So when they launched, they went viral, all this sort of stuff. And it was sort of like the golden age of social networks at the time. So there was a lot of, you know, hype and all this sort of stuff, and they grew very quickly. What happened to them is so technically they failed, but they still survive, and now they provide location data to mainstream applications. So in fact, you know, when you use Uber, you put a location in, an address. The mm-hmm. backend API for that is actually Foursquare.
Oh, no kidding.
So that's okay. What they provide. So technically we all use Foursquare, but they pivoted into something else. The reason I believe their social app or their consumer app didn't work was two reasons. One is the culture wasn't ready. Like, I think at the time, sort of the idea of, you know, posting a photo of like, whether it's your food or this restaurant you went to or like a sauna or travel or anything like that, like posting stuff online was very foreign at the time. Like, I didn't think people remember like what it was like 15 years ago. Now it's like, it's normal. Everyone's on Instagram. Everyone's posting a fucking photo of everything, right? You know, you can't go and eat food anymore without a bunch of people pulling out their cameras. It drives me crazy. So in my opinion, like the stickiness for Foursquare wasn't there at the time. I believe Instagram had to come first. And again, for better or worse, change the world, change the behavior, change how we actually use the web and how we use these social platforms. That was number one. Also, number two, I don't think the tech was ready. So again, 15 years ago, if you remember what the apps were like the, you couldn't build depth. There was no like UX, UI, like these things didn't really exist. Like you had very basic apps. And in fact, the more basic, the better it was. Which is why, I mean, even Instagram, people don't know this actually, but before Instagram was Instagram, it was called Bourbon and it was actually like Foursquare. It was a location app for places where you could check in, you could tell people where you're going, you could recommend stuff and everything, but it was too complicated for the kind of phones that we had at the time and for the designs that we had at the time and for the technical infrastructure and the tech stack and all that sort of stuff. So basically the culture wasn't ready, the tech wasn't ready, but I really actually think like, now is the time for multiple reasons. Like the culture has changed and I don't think we're ever going back to a pre-Instagram age where people don't share what they do. I think that is always going to exist now. Like we're in the age of the social internet, right? So that has changed. Number two, the tech is ready. So now we have things like Nostra, we have things like Bitcoin, we have even things like AI. The way we're using AI in our app is not just building a fucking chatbot in there, but like anytime someone adds a location, so you can add like your favorite butcher or let's say your favorite carnival restaurant on the app, and you don't have to create the profile. We have a whole pipeline of AI agents that will go and scour the web and actually create the profile on Atlantis for you. You don't have to do shit. Then it's discovered by you. And then we can reach out to the merchant and say, hey, you can come and claim your profile because people are recommending you, people are collecting, you know, bookmarking you and everything like that. And then when those merchants come and claim their profile, they actually become a Nostra user and they don't even know. Like we have onboarded them onto Bitcoin and Nostra without us even dropping the word. And that comes from the crowd, like sort of sourcing this. So that's how we're sort of using AI. I think you've also got like the third piece is this sort of rise of the location independent lifestyle, like people wanting to have more, you know, a borderless life. And then fourth is that they're frustrated with what social media has become. You know, they want something that feels a little bit more analog, feels a little bit more networky. So I think like literally now is the time for an application like this. And I just don't think, I think Foursquare was like the sort of the genesis point for something like this. But I think now that the world's changed 15 years later, like what we're trying to construct here with Atlantis is like, yeah, Foursquare 2.0, but something that is like far more powerful and far more compelling and just the right time, the right thing, the right culture, the right tech, everything is like lining up for this, I think.
So I think you've done it probably as well describing Atlantis as you can without people just going in and checking it out. Yeah. So I would just encourage anyone listening, like go in and play with it. Cause it's like, if it feels ethereal when you're, you know, when you're trying to describe all of these things and backing into sort of how you got here. It's a cool app. And I will say, I think I got on Nostra originally like through Damas or Primal a couple years ago. And, kind of left it behind for a while, came back to it. It feels the interfaces of these tools feel much better. It seems like things are just kind of ticking in a way that maybe they weren't a couple of years ago. And so I think you're kind of benefiting to some degree just from, you know, adoption. Maybe it stalled a bit, but like it seems like there are improvements to the products and a clear understanding of how to build on Nostra.
Primal is, I would still say Primal is still the gold standard app. It is the best app on there because it's been, in my opinion, it's got a very strong team behind it and they've been around long enough to really like smooth out the rough edges. So if people want like a Twitter alternative, that's the thing. But, you know, for those people that are listening, like if you're a Nostra, you're already actually on Atlantis. So you just take your key and you just download the app and you log in with your NSEC and you're there. You'll see your content, your followers, everything is there. But you're using it for a different purpose. And that's sort of been my thing is like, I don't think I want to say this in a nice way so I don't sound like a fucking asshole, but like, I don't know how useful it is to build a Twitter clone and just do zaps. I don't think that's compelling enough for people because like the conversation is still happening on Twitter as much as we like it or not, which is why what you often see is people just posting the same thing on Primal and Twitter, right? Like, and I don't think
that's... Guilty.
Yeah. I mean, I've done the same fucking thing, you know? So it's like, I don't know if that's compelling enough, which is why my approach is like, okay, let's do something that actually doesn't exist on the web today or is done extremely poorly, right? Which is TripAdvisor. Like TripAdvisor hasn't changed in 25 years. For fuck's sake, it's the same app. You know, meetup.com hasn't changed in 20 years. It's the same freaking app. So like, let's actually try and build something new and, you know, do a novel use case for the social graph. And that's like where I get excited. It's like, okay, if this doesn't work, nothing's going to work for Nostr. Like, you know, no amount of like circle jerking ourselves and saying, oh yeah, free speech, Twitter. Like, I'm sorry, but Elon already made Twitter free speech enough. No one is coming to Nostr for a free speech version of Twitter. That ship has sailed. We need to find something else that's useful. And in the process, move the web back over to something that is a little bit more sovereign and a little bit more censorship resistant. Like that shouldn't be the pitch. That should be the medicine that's hidden, you know, in the food, basically. Like it reminds me of when my wife wants to give the dog like medicine, she hides it in the fucking food. That's it. That's how you got to do this stuff.
Yeah. Would you say, last question on the app itself, would you say, so I'm not an Instagram user, would you say it's more akin to like the feel of Instagram versus like a Twitter? Is that maybe a way of,
a bit more,
of saying
it? It's more visual. It's more image centric, particularly the profile. So we've structured the profile less as a personal feed, more as a grid. I don't know if that will keep that, you know, I've been sort of back and forth on like, you know, whether we, again, maybe move away from the entire like feed paradigm as a profile and maybe have something more like almost like a bio page instead of like a profile of your post, and maybe just have a tab where you can see a feed and maybe a tab where you can see your grid and kind of make those things secondary. But this is, again, it's all in flux. Like I want to build something new. That's the big thing here. I don't want to fucking rehash what already exists and just build a clone and put it on Nostr. I don't think that's interesting. I think this is, I've always been someone that wants to kind of like define a new category and build it. And I think that gets me fucking excited.
Yeah. So tell me about, you've raised some money for this. Could you tell me a little bit about who's contributed? It sounds to me like maybe there are ways for your average Bitcoiner, Nostr, super user type folk to get involved as well. Is that right?
There is. So I think you asked me offline about Prague. So in Prague, we did a first release of the product in Prague. And alongside that release, we also announced that we would be doing like an equity crowdfund. So last year we raised the seed. We did 1.7 mil and there's some familiar faces on there. So like we got some investment from Axiom, which is, you know, led by Alan Farrington and the guys, Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, which is like James Lavish, Larry Lepard, Mark Mawson, all the guys, TimeChain Capital, HCM Capital, who's actually backed by Foxconn, the makers of the iPhone. But the one I'm most like psyched about and proud of is Ross Stevens. So he's like, I mean, he's been a supporter of mine for a while now, and I fucking love the guy. He's a genius. He's quiet. He's reserved. Like when he speaks, everyone listens. Like he's like the archetype of what I would consider like a successful man, right? And yeah, he helped lead the round. So we raised a great round then. Our plan is to do a Series A next year. But then someone reached out to me. They're like, dude, have you thought about doing like a crowdfund so that like the public, like retail, can get involved? And I was like, oh shit, I didn't think of that. And it kind of just like aligns really well because we're a consumer app. And it's sort of like, imagine if you could have owned like a piece of Amazon or a piece of like Instagram or Facebook or something like that early on, right? You know, you couldn't do that back then. Like the idea of equity crowdfunding didn't exist. So, and to be clear as well, this is like, what we're doing is an equity crowdfund. It's not like a Geyser crowdfund where you're buying a product. Like, you know, people probably know me. I've done a couple of Geyser crowdfunds. Like I did the Bushido on there. I did on Communist on there and all this sort of stuff. Where you're buying a book, you're buying a product. That's different. What this is you're actually buying a piece of the company. Like you're actually owning shares in the company. So it's almost like buying public stock, but the company is still private. And, you know, you can do like $500, you can do $1,000, you can do $5,000, $10,000, whatever you want. So we launched that at BTC Prague, and the goal is we're going to do 400K, maybe 500K through the equity crowdfund. Actually, what am I saying? No. We announced it at BTC Prague. We launched it 3 or 4 weeks later. So it's been live for about a month. And this is the first podcast I'm doing on it. So, you know, there's about 150K raised there of the 400. So people can jump in and contribute and own a piece of what I hope will be the, call it the future app for sovereign individuals, like for the borderless lifestyle.
I love it. Okay. So I'm curious. We've touched on Bitcoin. It's kind of come in and out of the conversation. What does all of this have to do with Bitcoin to the extent that it has anything? And I'm curious, as a company, are you, I'd be surprised if you say we're trying to be the next MicroStrategy, but, or Strategy, but is there like a treasury play as you think about like, hey, how do we as a company, you know, sort of build our war chest, our financial war chest, and, you know, succeed into the future? What are you thinking about there?
100%. So let me answer that in two parts. So one is my evil master plan to make it the most important Bitcoin product in the world, which is not an evil plan. But I mentioned before really briefly, I said anyone can add places to the map, right? So if we want Bitcoin to succeed, we need mass merchant adoption. You need mass like commerce happening with Bitcoin, right? Like that's the long-term vision. Going to people and going to the average merchant, the average restaurant, saying you should accept Bitcoin, 99.9% of the time is going to get you laughed out of there because they don't fucking want to. So we need to think of a sly roundabout way to get them on Bitcoin. So the way Atlantis works is we currently have about 20,000 merchants already on the map, right? And that has come from us basically scraping things like Michelin. So we've got every Michelin restaurant on there, everything from Michelin map. We've got everything from Seedall Scout. So like anything that's like Seedall free and all that sort of stuff is on there. We've got all of the Bitcoin accepting merchants on there. We've got local farmers markets. We've got all this sort of stuff that we've pulled already into the map. But then we have like thousands of places that people have like recommended themselves. It's like, this is the best cafe. This is the best sauna to go to. This is the best, you know, co-working space. This is the best restaurant, sushi, whatever the fuck you want, right? And people are adding this. By the time people listen to this episode, we're going to release the new feature, which is collections. And a collection is kind of like a bookmark folder that you can share. It's really easily shareable. It's almost like imagine a Spotify playlist, but for places, right? And, you know, people can save other people's collections and there's kind of like a social element to it. But you can create a collection one by one, or you can import your Google map that you might have already created a list. Like, I'm a bit autistic, so I have fucking lists for everything. And there's a lot of these like sort of collectors. So they'll be able to import it. And I anticipate that by the end of the year, we'll probably have like 200,000-300,000 places on the map. Once we hit a certain threshold, we will have all of it. Because remember, when someone adds a place to the map, our AI agent goes and it reads every single review, pulls in their address details, pulls in their opening details, their photos and everything, creates a profile. So they have a rich profile on the app. And you can go see that right now. You go to any merchant that's available in there, you see a beautiful profile. Once we have people collecting them and recommending them, we will just email all of these merchants. Imagine 200,000-300,000 merchants. We email them. We say, hey, Mr. So-and-so, guess what? You're invited to claim your account on Atlantis. It's completely free. 35 people have recommended you. 50 people have already bookmarked you. Come and claim your account. It's free. Like so there's like literally no downside for them to do it. We haven't mentioned Bitcoin, haven't mentioned Nostra, haven't mentioned any of that. We've just said that people are recommending you and collecting you. Come and claim and own your account. My hypothesis is that that's going to have a high conversion ratio. So they will come, they'll claim their account, they'll create a Atlantis account. Boom, they're on fucking Nostr and they are Bitcoin enabled. We didn't drop the word Nostr, we didn't drop the word Bitcoin, but now they have a wallet, they have an MPUB, they're set up on there, they can post content, they can interact with their audience and everything. And now all of a sudden, you have 100,000, 200,000 merchants on the network that have a Bitcoin wallet that are all set up. Now, they might not initially use the Bitcoin or anything like that, but it's fucking there. And people might zap them, might tip them, might suggest something else. In time, we'll also build out merchant features where they can add their menu on there. Maybe people can order directly. And we start to build an entire commerce network on this thing where we didn't even have to convince them with Bitcoin up front. I think that is like, that's my coup de grace. That's like what I want to do over the next couple of years is like get a million merchants onto Sotlantis. And by default, they get a Bitcoin wallet, but never pitch it as a Bitcoin thing. Pitch it as this is the place where you want to be for collections, for maps, and for this whole new class of people who are looking for the best places to eat, to experience, to drink, to catch up, to do all that sort of stuff. So that's like, that's how Bitcoin sort of flows into the product. How we're going to approach the treasury thing. So yes, we're totally not going to be the next MicroStrategy. I'm not doing a Sailor thing here. We're not public. Unfortunately, I can't issue shares and build an MNAV and all that sort of stuff. But I don't think that's, I think that's a kind of a glitch in the matrix at the moment, which is sort of this like pure play Bitcoin treasury cos. I think that's very interesting at the moment. I think there's only going to be a few winners. I know some people are like, oh, you know, everyone's going to make a lot of money out of this. I actually think there's probably going to be like 10 or 20 winners in that space. And it'll probably be like one or two per major jurisdiction. I don't think there's a lot of space for like a pure play Bitcoin treasury company. What I anticipate will happen in this thing is that there will be hundreds or even thousands of them pop up. And then we'll have a boom cycle. And then a bunch of them are going to go fucking bust because no one's going to give a shit about them. And they're going to put their money where there's more trust and more leverage or more capacity for leverage. And those ones will maintain an MNAV and everybody else will get crushed. Because once you go below the MNAV, then you have this like sort of spiral effect and you die very quickly. So like leverage works both ways, right? So my interpretation is that Treasury Company 1.0 will probably last for the next 12 to 18 months. We'll see a boom bust cycle. But then off the back of that, it will basically open up the mental space for every other company in the world to say, hey, wait a minute. I'm actually a real business that has real customers, that generates real money. And I currently just accept payments in fiat. Maybe we should accept some payments in Bitcoin, but B, maybe it's even easier just to hold some Bitcoin on our balance sheet. And that's what we'll do. And I think that's what sort of like Treasury Company 2.0 is basically great businesses that either have a Bitcoin element to them or store some of their money in Bitcoin, which is basically, in my opinion, like that's a healthy way to do Bitcoin treasury. And this, I mean, it's not new. It's not like foreign. And the best company that's doing that right now is River, run by Alex Leishman out of New York. You know, River Financial, like, They're chads, man. Like, they've got Bitcoin on their balance sheet. They keep their profits in Bitcoin. Like, they just operate. Like, it's a fucking beautiful business. Like, we've done the same thing. Since day one, when we raised capital, we held 50% of it in Bitcoin and we used 50% of it in cash to run the business and operate. And as soon as we start to monetize the app, we'll have Bitcoin monetization directly. We'll also have fiat. Like, you know, the thing is you can't just close yourself off to one, because if you're trying to build a functional business, you need to bring people from both sides of the world in. But as long as you have the optionality there, we'll keep our Bitcoin income in Bitcoin. We'll keep our fiat income in fiat. We'll use fiat for operations and we'll keep building a healthy Bitcoin treasury. So I think that's, for me, that's the right way to do it. And I think that's how the future sort of Bitcoin and Bitcoin treasury company is going to work.
Yeah, I can't tell you how much I love that. For anyone who's listened to our channel or heard me speak on this, they know my frustration with sort of, as you describe it, treasury companies 1.0. I think that I hope the future belongs to the companies who are good, profitable businesses. They stack sats, they convert their existing treasury to Bitcoin, and they start accepting it as payment and contribute as a node to like the circular economy that we're talking about and that you're helping to build. So, hey man, I think that's a good place to wrap up. I got one last question for you because I ask everyone, and that's, what is an unpopular opinion that you have, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it?
Shit, man, I'm gonna go with the most unpopular opinions. All right, what's the most offensive one? I am gonna go with. Let's do this one. I think Bitcoin's going to bring back feudalism. And I think feudalism is the most superior state. because you get hierarchy again, and you get hierarchies of competence. I think we have been fed this bullshit in the modern world that feudalism was backwards and, you know, all this sort of bullshit, but I don't think it was. I actually think it was far more functional than the fake feudalism that we have today. And I think the way Bitcoin does that is by recreating a social structure whereby if you hold Bitcoin and you have the capacity to build a lineage, you end up basically having a mechanism to reestablish nobility, and you start to reestablish like social strata again. And with nobility actually comes duty, and it comes, you know, what was sort of traditionally called noblesse oblige. And you actually start to create a nice, strong triangular foundation back to civilization in such a way that, you know, people once again know sort of where they are, but you have like a permeability to it. So it's like, I would call it meritocratic feudalism, where you can actually move up and down classes, but the classes are a little bit more clear and a little bit more understood, so that people are no longer kind of brainwashed by this stupidity that, hey, we're all the same and we can all do everything. No, we're not all the same, and no, we can't all do everything. We're all sort of got our differences, and if we understand what those differences are, we can have a multifaceted society again. And in my opinion, sort of Bitcoin leads us back to kind of the age of kings and queens. And the age of kings and queens, by definition, will sort of bring us back to a more triangular feudal structure, which is more stable, more functional, and has more opportunity for prosperity.
I love it, man. That's I think people will be triggered by the terminology, but I think the way you frame it though is very helpful. And you hit on some, the meritocracy. I mean, the people who deliver value can move up in the ranks, so to speak, and the people who don't won't. But there's that's what I think Bitcoin does help fix are some of those incentives.
For sure.
If you can't deliver value, then there's probably not going to be a lot of upward mobility for you, and it's going to incentivize people to build their skills, to increase in virtue, to do a lot of the things we've talked about today. So
really
awesome, man. Alex, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much. Tell people where they can find you, follow you, Satlantis, your book, anything else you want to share.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So obviously, find me on Satlantis. That's the best place. So satlantis.io/Svetsky. You'll find me there. So that's that doubles as my Nostr account, but also as obviously my Satlantis account, which is where I do most of my posting now. I do still post on Twitter, so I'm still on there. Just search for Svetsky. You'll find two accounts actually on Twitter. My main account, Svetsky Writes, and then I actually got my old account unbanned from back in the day. So there's an Alex Svetsky there, but that one's not active. And then yeah, people should check out Satlantis. Come join. Check it out, like reach out to me. We don't have messaging on there yet, unfortunately. Messaging is a little bit trickier to build than what we originally planned, but who knows? By the time this goes out, maybe that'll be ready. And yeah, like any questions, any comments, any feedback, anything like that, come hit me up. Would love to engage more with the community. As I said, this is my first real sort of podcast back on the road show to talk about what we're building. So I'm going to be a hell of a lot more public over the coming months as I kind of bring this to market and create the feedback loops. So I'm pumped for it.
Love it. The world will be better for it. Alex, appreciate your time, man.
Thanks,
cheers.
Mike. Appreciate it.
And that's a wrap. Again, hope you enjoyed my conversation with Alex. Learned something new about Nostr. Go check out Satlantis. Go buy Bushido a Bitcoin. It is true that someday we are all going to have generational wealth. We need to know how to live with virtue. This is a fantastic read. It's lengthy, but below time preference. Get it anyway. Support his work. And of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into 100% self-custody, doing it the right way the first time, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We'd love to chat with you. We can also help you with online cybersecurity, setting up privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option. We can even help you set up and configure a solo miner so you can start playing the lottery every 10 minutes and learn a bit more about mining.
Again, it's thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can follow us on X. We're at @thebitcoinway_. You can also look us up on Noster. So go to Setlanis and check out The Bitcoin Way. You can follow me on Twitter as well. It's at @theothermjordan. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.